Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us. Gregory Isaacs passed on this day, so we were playing his music to remember Gregory Isaacs and the wonderful contributions he gave to our music, our culture, and our life. We're about to have a conversation now with Dietrich Muhammad, Senior Director of the Economic Department of the National NAACP, Executive Director of the NAACP's Financial Freedom Center, and he's here to talk about how race is a factor in this new report that came out of Stanford University on residential segregation by income in America, how this has grown exponentially across all racial lines. 1970 to 2009, about people are now being segregated by class in deeper ways when it comes to where we live, how it affects our lives and schools and jobs and more. And again, the separation of America. And Dietrich joins us once again. Dietrich, good to have you with us.
Good to be on.
Always good to have you here. So the class divide in America is clearly been deep for a long time, and it's growing deeper. We've seen that one of the things this report talked about is the kind of the demise of middle-class neighborhoods, period, across the state of America. Fewer and fewer people living in them, more and more people living in neighborhoods of poverty and wealth at either end.
Yes, no, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, there's been a good amount of reporting. I know your show's been looking at the increased income inequality as a whole, increased wealth inequality as a whole over the last 30, 40 years, and this report is looking at how how we are becoming more segregated, too, by these income and wealth differences. And so in the 70s, you would have had a larger proportion of Americans living in middle-income neighborhoods. Now you see increases where people are more likely to live either at a more affluent neighborhood or neighborhood that is more low-income and what would be considered middle-income neighborhoods, taking the kind of median family income of your area, there's just less and less people living in that type of neighborhood.
But why as I was looking at this report and thinking about your kind of analysis of what goes on in terms of race and the class divide and housing and how this looks at that, one of the things I thought about, DJ, I don't know if it's right to start here or not, but I'll start here anyway,
okay,
which is when I looked at the numbers that happened from 1970 to now in terms of where people of color, especially African Americans, have lived in deeply segregated by class neighborhoods, doing segregation, which nobody wants to go back to, but doing segregation, folks were forced to live with communities within each other so that working class people, poor working class people, lived in fairly close proximity to middle class folks because that was the nature of segregation. And that changed markedly so that people are more isolated than ever now.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, and this report only goes back to 1970s, but
right.
I'm sorry, to 1970, but you know, I think you can kind of fairly assume that that was true in the 60s as well. That because of outright racial segregation, there was just not opportunity for African Americans to mirror the income segregation that kind of white America had, where if you had money in white America, you could then move to a more wealthy neighborhood. That just oftentimes, I think there was always one thing that I'm not sure this captures is, though there was still income segregation in that you lived closer to lower income black people, but there might be one part of the city where blacks lived, and then part of that part of the city would be where the upper-income blacks would live, and then another part of that city would be where lower-income blacks is. But I think clearly the distance between the two of low-income African Americans, middle, high-income Americans. So, you can look at Baltimore. I mean, I think oftentimes there was, people recognize there was a push from kind of inner-city Baltimore to the county, to Baltimore County. What's interesting now, though, is that as well you're having a kind of a suburbanization of the poor as a whole, and I'm not sure what type of effects that'll have in the future about income segregation. But clearly, the kind of less containment, outright strict racial segregation has allowed for African Americans, which is a positive thing, allowed for African Americans to be able to move more freely. But part of that is strengthening the kind of income segregation that's prominent throughout the rest of society.
One of the things that is a finding here, let me just read this to you and kind of jump off at this point. And folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888 because I think this report is kind of critical. And I think that Dietrich Muhammad's spin on this report and the analysis coming out of his work at NAACP kind of takes this report to a different level. But one of the things that was said was, it said, in short, racial segregation coupled with income segregation means that low-income Black and Latino families, well, they said, wrote Hispanic, will tend to cluster in communities that are disadvantaged along a number of dimensions, such as average educational attainment, family structure, and unemployment. So let's parse that out of the words of a researcher. What does that mean in reality?
Well, and let me highlight something else, because I think it's, to me, it's still a little bit of a confusing picture of what this report is saying, because it also says in the report, and you probably want to get to this, that it's also true that low-income white Americans are oftentimes living in neighborhoods with higher income than middle-class African Americans. So it's a little bit of a confusing picture, because clearly there seems to be greater isolation for poor Blacks and Latinos. Well, actually, I guess maybe some ways it doesn't contradict. There is greater income segregation for poor Blacks and Latinos than there are for poor whites. And in fact, poor whites seem to be living in neighborhoods with higher median income than even a Black middle class family. So it shows, you know, it still shows how race distorts classic income and what would be considered class inequalities in this country, because you would think that that middle-class Black Americans would be in neighborhoods with higher income than low-income whites. And I think this also, you know, this gets into this whole wealth inequality piece too, how income alone doesn't highlight your ability, your opportunity in this country. It really is wealth and how little wealth African Americans, even African American middle class and high income, have. So even though they might be able to get out of maybe what was a truly isolated ghetto, they're still not being able to experience a middle income community the same way that white America is, and not even the same way that low income whites are, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the what you're referring to was this piece where they wrote just after that, saying, in contrast, low income white families, although affected by income segregation as well, tend to live in neighborhoods with larger average incomes than even middle-class Black and Latino families. Thus, white families are able to buy up, while Black and Latino families buy down.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it can be somewhat confusing is you think if, you know, there's greater income segregation in the African American community, that, you know, that the Black middle class is able to really put itself in a much stronger middle class position and has left the kind of poor Black community. But what you're seeing is there is greater distance between the poor Black middle class, I mean, between the poor Blacks and middle class Blacks, but still Black middle class is not able to be in the same type of neighborhoods as even lower income white Americans. And so there's still this kind of stark racial divide there.
So there are a bunch of things you said here. We, in the time we have together here, we're going to take a break in like 5 minutes, but come back to finish this conversation after the break, that I'm really curious about, and how you parse out analytically and what you think to do both politically and in terms of how do you change this scenario in America. When you say that the Black middle-class families are in a different situation than white middle-class families in terms of their financial ability, can you pull that a little deeper for us? What does that mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, what that means is, and I'm pulling off of some Pew research work, and I'm not looking at the numbers.
Yeah, that's okay.
I can give you, you know, the general estimates, is that, you know, we see that at every level, African Americans have much less wealth than white Americans. And that I'm pretty sure this is true. The middle income white American, or sorry, the kind of middle wealth white American has more wealth than a high income African American. And so, you know, the difference between income and wealth, right, is obviously how much money you are making in a year is income, and then how much assets you have when you look at your total kind of liabilities, your expenses, and then how much income and assets you have afterwards, and the leftover is your wealth. And, you know, wealth is something that's accumulated oftentimes over generations. And for many African Americans, this is first, second generation middle class or high income. and because of the disparities of the past have, and because their communities as a whole are so wealth poor, do not have the same type of wealth, financial capital that allows them to put down a strong down payment or house them, gives them a strong savings. And so you have, you know, many black middle-income households who still have very little wealth or trying to support their parents. Instead of getting some financial support from their parents. And so it limits your ability to get into different types of neighborhoods, to have access to different types of opportunities. So, we look a lot about the kind of growth of the black middle class, but in some ways I would argue much of the black middle class isn't truly middle class, because without wealth, without the financial stability of wealth, you're not truly middle class in America. You're someone who has a little bit of higher income, but is still living paycheck to paycheck, and that is so much of the African American, I'd say, middle income and even higher income.
So it's there's so many things here. There's a complex to deal with. And one of the things I thought about, and I want to come back to a report I read earlier in August about white poverty in America, and talk a bit about that after the break. But I was thinking about this in terms of the fund drive that WEAA just finished here, mm-hmm. a public radio station at Morgan State University, where the majority of listenership is African-American, not completely, but the majority, at a historically black college. The difference between what can be pledged at this station and what gets pledged at stations that where the audience is mostly white. I'm just being told we have to take a break here, correct? We're going to pick up on that point when we come back with Dietrich Muhammad and explore this a little deeper as we go out. We're going out with the late, great Gregory Isaacs, My Only Lover. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Dietrich Muhammad from the NAACP as we look at income wealth in America, income disparities in America. Gregory Isaacs. We are still here with Dietrich Muhammad, Senior Director of the Economic Department at the NAACP, Executive Director of the NAACP's Financial Freedom Center, here to talk about how race is a deep factor in this new report out about socioeconomic segregation in America. And so there's a couple of things I want to try to raise in the 10 minutes or so, 15, whatever it is that my producers will let me know we have left. And I just left off at the break with WEAA and other mostly African-American stations. And you can see that the not just the pledge levels, but what the expectations are for stations like this where they can raise as opposed to what can be raised in mostly white communities through public radio. That to me, when I was looking at that of this week of pledges around the country, and then I started scanning stations around the country, listening to what they were asking for, how much they were asking for, how much they were getting, the income equality by race just really and wealth just really struck home.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think you looked at almost at any type of, let's say, either black institution or institutions in predominantly black communities, and you see kind of these disparities in, you know, what communities are able to give, right? Because if African Americans are, as a whole, there's still great income inequality, African Americans compared to white Americans, African Americans making, depending how you look at it, around 60, 65 cents on every dollar that white Americans make. So that alone would explain a disparity in, you know, what people have to give. But then if you look at wealth inequality, where, you, again, depending on what studies you use, you can see anything between African Americans and Latinos actually having about 10% of the wealth of white Americans all the way to only having a 20th of the wealth of white Americans. If you, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, to be getting paid $40,000 a year, but it's another thing if you have no savings and you have debt, how much liquid income do you have to be able to give out and give to a radio station or give to your college that might be predominantly black, or give to your local church or what have you. So income, wealth inequality is kind of and I think it's that's even what this report is getting to, is that when you have communities that are more segregated by their economic resources, you are also weakening the and you're keeping people in communities with weakened institutions, because these institutions oftentimes are not getting the same type of financial investment as institutions that would be in higher income, higher wealth communities. And I think, you know, that is why this is such a challenging report for the future of the economy of the country, because what we're doing is we're setting up structures to repeat and strengthen inequality. And, you know, the whole racial component as well, as America is increasingly become majority minority, and that's why it's so important to look at how Latinos are doing in this type of income segregation, because they're becoming a rapidly growing part of this country. And if we get to 2040, when the country's majority minority, and we're finding that communities are, you know, more and more segregated by income, and then there's a strong racial component, we're just having a more and more divided America with a larger percentage of America not getting the type of resources and investment that have particularly been part of the kind of the American mainstream. We're finding the American mainstream is kind of being whittled away into a larger have-nots with some have.
So let me get two other quick questions. We have about 7 or 8 minutes left here, Diedrich, in this segment. But the one has to do with going backwards and thinking about, I mean, also thinking about the issue of reparations, which has caused a huge divide in America whenever this issue is brought up. And so I think because we really haven't had a discussion in America about what it really means in a deeper sense, you know, taking it beyond the question, well, writing a check to every black family in America. But but to talk about the wealth and where it's derived from, and how much, you know, I was a dear friend here at the station, met with family members who met with the people who actually were descendants of the people who owned her descendants, I mean, owned her ancestors, you know, and how he went off to Harvard, Yale, and all this other stuff, and was able to do all this stuff, and she realized that it was her dad who was. Who had been, he went to the post office and make a middle class life, and she was the first generation to go to college. This kind of stuff is at the heart of things, and how to have that discussion without it kind of deteriorating into the baloney discussions we have around reparations, but the reality of where wealth comes from, and how it affects the 21st century, even though it's based in centuries before us.
Yeah, no, and I think it's such a hard discussion because it goes against such an ingrained kind of myth in America that that, you know, whatever you have in America, you deserved, you earned through your particular hard work. And it doesn't, you know, represent the fact that actually, you know, most of us are either supported or are challenged by what had happened in past generations or what past generations were able to do. And for some of us along a racial divide, if you're – and, you know, and I see this. Well, my mother is white. My father is black. I see very clearly the differences. Even though my dad's family was a black middle-class family and my mom's family was a white middle-class family for a couple generations back, they have very different outcomes and very different meanings of what that is. So my dad's family was a black middle-class family. But because of segregation, their black middle-class home rapidly became what would be considered the ghetto and became what was a great opportunity, which pretty much all inner cities were, became South Central Los Angeles. And so their home values were very limited. Their educational opportunities were very limited. And you look at the white side of the family and you see that, you know, the kind of the home values managed to, you know, stay more the same. And even looking at two sides of the family, you know, the family members who both dropped out of college and the type of opportunities that I see on the white side of my family, where I have cousins who dropped out of college, but they're just working for an uncle who owns a small business. While on the black side of my family, there is no uncle that owns a business that can just hire them. And so they're much more limited in their employment prospects. So it challenges the kind of notion that you get what you deserve. You know, that isn't really true on either end. It doesn't mean that people aren't working hard all across the spectrum, but there's a lot larger forces in effect.
And I guess we can't do this today, but I would like to come back and kind of also spread this conversation out to talk about you know, when you say when the latest studies show that 4 out of 5 American adults are struggling with joblessness, near poverty existence, reliance on welfare, and more, that there are tens of millions, if not over hundreds of millions, of white families that are stuck in poverty or near poverty. That's the reality as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it's the reality as well that for all, you know, median income Americans that you know, our incomes haven't been rising at the same level as costs have been rising. Costs, whether they be healthcare costs, childcare costs, these types of things. And so, and this is kind of what makes it really dangerous, because it's easier to see other people suffering when you're doing okay. But
right.
When you're suffering, it makes it that much harder to see what's happening to other communities and how even more devastating it might be, because, you know, clearly when you're facing your own challenges, it's hard to see others.
It's always a pleasure to have you with us, Dietrich Muhammad, Senior Director of Economic Department at NAACP and Executive Director of the NAACP's Financial Freedom Center. Always great to talk to you, Dietrich. Thank you so much.
Great being on. Look forward to the next time.
Take care. We're going to take a very brief break and come back and look at the Affordable Health Care Act, but what about the single-payer alternative here in the struggles in Maryland? And we'll visit Vermont, where they actually instituted a statewide single-payer. Could that happen here? Stay with us. Fire bread.